This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
This is The 11th Hour. I'm Páraic Branagh. Welcome to this week's selection from The 11th Hour podcast. Tonight's show is a sort of a school reunion meets a school farewell, as past pupils and teachers gather together to mark the closing of Greendale Community School in Kilbarrick, North Dublin. The school will close down later this year after serving the community since 1974. Some of the country's creative talent who graced and raced through these corridors are returning tonight for a reception at which 2,000 people are expected. In a little while I'll be talking to writer Roddy Doyle, playwrights Paul Mercer and Linda Welch, academic Dr. Sophia Hillen, amongst others. But first, Principal Anton Carroll, you've been at the school from the start. What is so extraordinary about Greendale?
Well, it's been a very pleasant place to be, a very vibrant community, great community spirit. I really enjoyed the interaction with the community. I enjoyed the pupils, their sharp wit, their joy of life, and their positive attitude, generally speaking. And one of the things that I find most endearing is their friendliness and their warmth when they acknowledge you in the street. And I have never come across any one of them who had a bitter word to say. I've found them an extraordinarily generous people.
The school has a reputation for being very creative, very integrated, very...
I think from the outset there was a seminal influence in the early days. I would have to acknowledge him. Well, in particular, I'd have to acknowledge Father John Brady, a Jesuit, who was very keen on the idea of being liberal. And we certainly, from the outset, were determined that we would not become an authoritarian institution. We wanted to affirm students, to treat with them more on an equal basis than in an authority relationship. And that was imbued, I think, from the word go in everyone who was recruited. So there was a policy in the early days that recruitment generally was of young people. The attitude of the board at the time, which was quite enlightened, was they didn't really want to bring in people who brought old ways, old stale ways. They wanted people with a fresh approach to education, a willingness to be, I suppose, to relate to students almost in a different style to what was the traditional and accepted style prevailing in Ireland at the time. And I think that to some extent you can judge for yourself the outcome of that. You know, I think there's a particularly warm bond between former pupils and former teachers. The friendliness is perceptible, I think, even here this evening.
Sophia Hillen, you were one of the first members of the staff here. Were you all hippies or what, from the 60s, starting off a new school?
We were not hippies. We were models of decorum. But we were very young. We were all, as Anton says, we were all very young. I think I'd been teaching for 1 year. And there were 10 teachers, 10 young teachers. We were we ranged from early 20s. I think Anton himself was the oldest. He was about 30, which we thought was terribly old. We did. And the students were all first year. So they ranged between 12 and maybe 14 at that stage. And there were 100 students, 10 of us. And we had boundless enthusiasm. We were going to change the world. We understood education as the drawing out of what was in the students. And yes, it was. We were full of energy. We were full of expectation, and I think that that showed. And there was a terrific rapport with the students and with ourselves. And we just put everything we could into it.
Roddy, when you joined a couple of years later, this ethos was well established, was it?
Yeah, I left school myself in 1976. Didn't like the place at all. I've never been back really. Still in contact with guys I went to school with. You'd never hear a word of affection from any of us about the place, you know. And then I came here. Came here 3 years later, did my H-dip here in 1979, and it was really quite an extraordinary experience. Even in the first few hours, the atmosphere was so different, so alive, so respectful. There was no corporal punishment. A good, you know, years before, it was made illegal. It just wasn't part of the place at all. And what was really, really quite a really pleasant shock was the level of friendliness between the staff and students, you know, stopping and chatting. And there was always room for, in my, you know, my experience, there was always room for laughter. There was always room for diversion, you know. And I fell hopelessly and stupidly in love with the place within a couple of days of having come here. I drifted in and stayed for 14 years, you know. Went home now and again for a shower, but more or less.
But what was the community like, Anton, when you arrived out here? It was a new community just starting off. What was it like?
Well, I think at the time, unemployment was very high in the area, probably exceeding 20%. People were struggling, there's no question about that. Times were hard. But from the word go, there was generally a very strong, supportive attitude from the community and from parents. They took a very active interest in the progress of the school. They seemed to take a kind of have a sense of involvement from the word go. And even in the 80s, when things were bad, you know, we were still out of a working class area, sending about 35% of our output to third level education, which was extraordinary for the time. And you know, there were extraordinary achievements. You know, families where three and four and maybe up to five went on to postgraduate studies, and I think one family produced five PhDs, and it was quite extraordinary. And you know, there have been other outstanding achievements. Like one of our former students was recently appointed professor in NUI, professor of neurological pharmacology or something like that, something extraordinarily sophisticated.
Roddy, part of the world. But Roddy, a question of, like, it wasn't the ethos alone. Surely there must have been some creative teaching methods or new thinking or new books, or which was just the ethos. Was the ethos alone enough to shift?
I've never quite known what ethos means, to be honest with you.
Well, you don't bait them up to start with. You don't hit them behind the lugs. That's the starting point.
It was just, I don't know, it was co-educational for a start, which in Ireland in 1979 seemed quite extraordinary, allowing boys and girls in the same room, with the lights on, granted, you know. And that was considered, you know, quite revolutionary, and I think in the heads of some people still is. And then there was the sheer size of the curriculum as well. I thought it was great. I mean, practical subjects mixed with the more academic subjects, and the school here was years and years ahead of anywhere else in northeast Dublin in that regard, you know. And but I think it was, again, it was probably something to do with the youth of the staff. And it's only in retrospect, really, that I realised that I was 21 and everybody else was, you know, a little bit older than a little bit younger. But we were all of an age, really. And the energy level in the staff room and around the corridors was phenomenal. And there was an awful lot of extracurricular stuff. And there wasn't a strict divide between that which was curricular and that which was extracurricular. You know, it was all, you know, we were always climbing mountains and putting on. It was a bit like a Judy Garland movie looking back at it.
This is before the strike over the £37 an hour to mind the playground, is it?
What's that, sir?
This is before the strike over the £37 an hour to mind the playground, is it?
I was well gone by then.
But Anton, this school was a comprehensive school. It was a new education idea in the early 70s. There were a few of them, yeah. Karen Donna, for example, and Cara Rowe here. What was different from a comprehensive school from a normal school at that time?
Well, I think Roddy touched on part of it there. The co-education was one thing. And, you know, funny enough, just a few years before this place was established, there was a case in Ballymun where the department had proposed a comprehensive school, and the bishop at the time, Archbishop John Charles McQuaid, insisted that they be segregated, boys and girls separately educated. They just, would you believe, amalgamated, I think, last year or the year before, after all those years. The comprehensive range of subjects, obviously, again, alluded by Roddy there, was another feature of the school. And we had, I think we offered about three or four European languages. We offered the whole range of the science mathematical choices, and then the practical subjects like technical drawing and woodwork, metalwork and so forth. So we did have the full range, which gave an opportunity for people whose aptitudes, you know, varied from being academic to perhaps being more practical and experiential learning talents, where I think given a rein here, which they may not have enjoyed in a strictly grammar school type of environment, where the emphasis would be exclusively academic and on the sort of cognitive rather than the other aspects.
But the experiential learning. The language of the school has been, celebrated in novel and in play and in... What was so unique about the students of Kilbarrick or of the area?
Well, you see, a number of the children had been living in Dublin, had been in the centre of the city, and they had come out to live here. It was a new estate, and the richness of the language was one of the things which most struck me at the beginning. And this, for me, I was hearing the language of O'Casey and the language of Joyce. So, and we were required to teach. We taught to the curriculum at that stage, and we would do everything Shakespeare done. We would do James Joyce. It was not difficult to teach James Joyce to children in Dublin. It was not difficult to teach Sean O'Casey. It was not difficult to teach Undermilk Wood, Dylan Thomas, because you simply went down to a room and you acted the thing out, and the children did it, the students did it. And they loved the language, and they extended the language, and they were open to all the possibilities of language, so that you did receive extraordinary work. And that, when you were receiving that work, when that was coming back, so you extended it further, you did more. You acted more, as Roddy said. We wanted to go to Stratford, well, we went to Stratford. You know, we wanted to go to France, we went to France. We simply did it. We collected, we went. And we were not restricted as teachers were restricted later on. We could do the things, we could do the extracurricular things. We put in the time. You know, very often our families didn't see us. But work and enjoyment, the whole, it was all part of it. There was a very strong bond, I think, between, I can only speak with the first 5 years, a very strong bond between the teachers, 10 the first year, another 10 the second year, another 10 the third year, and this growing group of students. So that there wasn't a full group of leaving cert through until 1980. That was the time I left, when the first generation, if you like, was through. But there was that sense of the thing growing and developing all the time. And the language and the development and the range of language was one of the extraordinary things about it, for me anyway.
And Roddy, you mined that rich vein of language to write a few novels. Was that the case?
yes and no. I mean, I arrived when I was 21, so I was like, I had my passport and I was able to vote. So I didn't come in a fetal state and pick up my English here. Do you know what I mean? And I grew up, you know, I'm from Kilbarrick, and I grew up, when I was a very young kid, I used to play on the building sites that became the houses outside the school here. And I remember one of the mysteries of my childhood was the platform at Kilbarrick Station, because there was a platform there for a long time before there was a station. And I didn't know what it was, really, what it was doing there. It only made sense when they built the station. And then,
the train, you know, stops here.
That's, yeah, so I saw the place being built up. And I think what it, I think maybe what the, what listening to people talking here incessantly all the time, day in, day out, for, you know, the for all the years I was here, it wasn't, it was very rarely the vocabulary which I had before I arrived and used myself when I was a kid, but it was the rhythm of the language, I think, which to me, I you know, whenever I'm editing my own work, it's always rhythm, and that, listening to young people talking, it's the rhythm. It's what's unique about Dublin speak, I think. It's just the rhythm of the language, not so much the vocabulary, but it's the rhythm, the delivery, the hesitations.
Is that the same since O'Casey? Is that still there? Is it, or is it change with the music and rap and different influences?
Oh, things change. Obviously, we don't live in a vacuum, so things change. So a word like man now, I'd have to... If I was rewriting... I wrote The Commitments 21 years ago. If I was writing it again today, then it would be still... You know, kids still play music and kids still want to escape, you know? If I was writing it, it would basically be the same book in many ways. Dublin would be a bit more complicated, I suppose. The word man I'd have to introduce, you know, it was a real hippie phrase when I was a kid, you know, hey man.
Which everybody has
but
enough.
Now it's like M apostrophe N, like man.
Man.
Where you going, man?
Where you going?
That type of thing. It's hard to capture on paper. I've tried it. So there would be little changes, but essentially it's the same. You know, I don't know, it's a bit like the death of the novel. It's announced on a regular basis, and the death of the Dublin accent is announced on a regular basis, and it doesn't happen. I mean, now you've got black kids and Eastern European kids with Dublin accents. So, I mean...
Fantastic.
And yeah.
It only adds to the rhythm of it.
Yeah.
We had them then, Roddy. We had them then. Mm. You know, we had children.
Multicultural
society. We did have that, and as I can only speak up until 1980, but we certainly did at that stage.
And you're a past pupil.
I am.
And you're a writer.
Yeah.
Did coming to school here and working with writers like Paul Mercer and Roddy, did that help you go along the journey towards being a writer?
Well, of course, I didn't know what the hell I was going to do. Academically, I was really quite poor in school, but I had a good imagination, and my ma actually sent me to Kilbarrick, because my brothers went to a Christian Brothers school, and they were a bit knackered at that. They were just like, oh, that's enough of that, sort of carry on. And they said to Matt, they said, send him to this new school. And thank God they did. And what did it do? I mean, I was very, very lucky in that I had Roddy as an English teacher. And, you know, of course we did the curriculum and all that sort of thing, but he had, at the bottom of the class, he had this old cabinet with loads of books in. And these were like modern classics that were in, and that really... a good few of us really, really got into it, got into, like, whatever, very sort of... My book at the time was, I think, The World According to Garp, was a favourite of mine, you know, and all this sort of stuff. And suddenly it was like, wow, God. And, you know, for a guy who academically wasn't great, I suddenly felt, oh, actually, you know, literature is a wonderful thing and really sort of quite wild. And at the same time, to have Paul Mercier, who's just a terrific playwright in the school as well. You know, they used to do versions of what was ever in the sort of curriculum. So we had a Othello, the Blacksmith of Kilbarrack, which is a great title, isn't it? I mean, you just had to write that. And that stuff, and Wuthering Depths, I thought was a personal favourite, you know. But all this sort of thing was great. So theatre was just a laugh and quite wild and quite flexible. So I went into college and did communications in college, and, you know, they tried to sort of smash any sort of originality that was sort of in me from Greendale. But there was still that sort of spark, and seeing the only theatre at the time, when you think about it, in the late 80s, God, there was someone, you know, someone was doing Molière plays, and the Gate were doing their thing, and the Abbey were, you know, killing sing. But Passion Machine and Paul Mercier were doing amazing work at that time. And that, you know, I mean, I was blessed that I had, you know, Roddy and Paul at that time, you know. And, you know, I write completely different types of work, but I've got, like, you know, a huge amount of respect for what they've done and what they've created, you know.
We have another past people here beside me. Stephen Mooney, you work in cartoon comic books.
Yeah, cartooning and animation.
A great education here for cartoon comic books, Greendale.
Yeah, it feels like I never left, yeah. No, it's the same as Enda's just saying. It was a very, very conducive atmosphere, the whole place. There was definitely a kind of a vibe about the place. It was very alive, you know what I mean? I was just thinking about it today when I knew I was going to be coming on here, that I was just talking to a few of the lads, and they were all just... We all just clicked back straight into the dials. If we were sitting in Mr. Doyle's English class, it was all letting fly.
Mr. Doyle.
Sorry, I haven't graduated to radio. I don't think... I don't know if it's just the way I'm brought up or if it's a... I don't know, I just can't. First name basis is never going to be achieved, but sure, they know I'm communicating with them, I think, because, you know...
You're still afraid of the teachers.
That's I was never afraid of the teachers. Like, maybe I should have been a bit more afraid of the teachers, I think, when Mr. Doyle was saying incessant conversation, I think half of that was me, but no, it was a fantastic place. The biggest thing was the encouragement you got from Mr. Carroll, Mr. Doyle, Mr. Mercer, whoever. I mean, I did my work experience with Mr. Mercer in the Project Arts set design. That's a long time. I just remember that the other day. I'd forgotten all about it. 3 weeks in there was fantastic. And Miss Gibson, Heather Gibson, the art teacher down there, was absolutely fantastic as well. It's just you really grew whatever. If there was any little seed, it was massaged, you know what I mean?
Well, did you grow anything else beside artists and writers and dramatists? And, we, a couple of PhDs, of course.
We had a few footballers here, you know, and sort of getting back to things that Roddy and said about language, you know. One of the people we had here along the way was a certain Kerry man who captained Kerry to an All-Ireland victory. But he wasn't here very long. He was called Mr. Hazard. a slight play on his name, you know. The kids here were really witty, you know. And they
I'm sure there was a metalwork teacher called Mr. Blunt. Is that right?
That's right.
That's right.
Yeah, and it was all that sort of thing. I know that Mr. Shallow used to bring people to the swimming. And I'd never bring them into the deep end. But that's...
We're not going to nickname them, sir.
I hope Liam Hassett forgives me for revealing that little secret.
No, we stick to Mr. here now for everybody from now on. You know?
Well, not me, if you don't mind.
Pardon me, madam.
Mom.
We're in Greendale Community School in North Dublin, and we're here with Roddy Doyle, Anton Carroll, Sophia Hillian, Enda Welch, Stephen Mooney, Paul Mercer, and me, Pádraig Branagh. We're talking about this school and how it has served the community in 1974, but it's closing down this summer. Enda, you were a student here, and there used to be a great programme on in Dublin years ago called Paddy Crosby School Around the Corner. It used to be a great expression, which was, tell us a funny incident there. Well, tell us a funny incident there, Enda, about your time in school.
I will tell you a funny incident. No, I won't. No, I will. Well, I've got loads of them. But I think I was really involved in athletics and loved it. And we were really good in sport at that sort of... But anyway, we're in some meet, I think it was the Dublins, and I came second in the high jump. I was pretty good on the old high jump. But we had the scruffiest athletics team. I mean, proper, like, scruffy. We had, like, you know, scruffy T-shirts and all this sort of thing. We had a 4x100 metre guys, and they were very, very good. Got into the final. They were up against the likes of Belvedere. And I'll never forget, these guys, they looked like the athletic homeless. They were just like, they were brutal looking, big hairy fellas and all this sort of thing. And so the race started and I looked at the guy who was like the fastest guy, if I can remember, I can't remember his name, he lived in Foxfield somewhere. He was the fastest, obviously, he was going to take the baton at fourth place. And the race had started and he was eating a Mars bar. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't. He just finished the Mars bar and obviously and chucked a wrapper on the ground, grabbed the bat and they won. And they beat these guys. And I was never so proud of a win, you know. I mean, just the nature of the win, the colourfulness. I just thought, fair whack to them. And anyway, so I can't watch a relay race without actually sort of thinking about eating Mars bars.
Get on to the Mars, but the advertising potential there, you know. But sports was an important factor in the school, Anton.
Yeah, sports was a very important factor. And actually, and I just mentioned the relay. We actually held the Leinster record for, I think, around about 25 years for the 100, the 4x100 relay, senior relay. And I remember that team, boy, they could motor. There was no question about it. I'd have to acknowledge the people who trained them in that, like Declan Walsh, who's still here, and Brian Mullins, of course, who hopefully will be joining us later on this evening, and Sheila Donnelly, apart from that, there was a huge amount of voluntary input from teachers generally, you know, because there was a fantastic spirit of mucking in to give a dig out to everybody else at the time. And, like, there were no lines of demarcation, really, you know, like, speaking there earlier about the writing and so forth, like, I remember Catherine Dunn, you know, who's an acclaimed author and own writer, and Roddy giving sort of lunchtime workshops and creative writing to kids. I think you were probably involved in that, Enda. But, people were extraordinarily generous. Teachers were extraordinarily generous. There was a fantastic spirit of generosity and willingness to be involved and quite sort of permeated throughout the whole establishment, really, you know.
But how did that feel as students, Enda, when you had, like, the English teacher writing films and novels and the Irish teacher putting on plays in the SFX?
You can imagine. I mean, it was properly cool. You know, this was good. This was like, you know, I mean, you'd watch. I mean, I think, was I in my Leaving Cert when the commitments came out? And actually, in the first publication, because it was produced. It was a small publication originally from
King Farouk.
And a group of the lads from our class were on the cover, weren't they?
That's right.
The likes of Kevin MacDonald and all that sort of carry on. So yeah, I mean, it was just fantastic. It was quite rock and roll, to be honest. It was great.
Can I just say something about that, Warwick? You know what Ed is just saying. I remember when the commitments was released, Roddy very generously arranged for a pre-release showing of the film to the whole school population. So, he hired about, I think, about 8 double-deckers. They arrived out here at about 10 o'clock one morning. And Roddy said to me in the bus on the way up, he said, you know, he said, we might have a bit of trouble here, you know. There's some colourful language in this. So, anyhow...
In the movie.
In the movie,
not on the bus.
You see, but I don't know. I was sitting beside Roddy and the movie started, you know, and the amazing thing was, nobody said a word about the language. They didn't even notice that the language was colourful.
Just after remembering the day after, I was in school, you know, teaching again the day after, and three young fellas came in. I knew them, and they had a band of their own. So it was a great film, sir, a great film. I said, thanks very much, lads. And they hung around for a while, and they said, will you write a song for our band? And it was just that lovely moment where, just for a tiny moment of my life, there were people in the world who thought I'd written Mustang Sally.
Right, just one thing on that film. We actually were the year, I don't know if you remember, sir, but sir. But we were in third year, our class, and I remember he came in, he stuck his head in the door and he said, listen, lads, I'm off to bring them all out to screen and the film's just after coming out, but listen, you can't come because you're 14. And we all just sat there gutted in the room, and we just had a study class because we were the year, the cut-off point where we couldn't go and see it because it was a 15 certificate.
Oh,
yeah,
that's terrible, that's terrible.
It's a terrible memory, yeah, so we didn't quite have the enthusiasm for the film career that the rest of them seemed to display at the time. But in hindsight, that was a good movie.
When you
eventually I waited a year and I watched it.
We're joined here in the room by the past pupils and past teachers of the school. We're here. Seamus Hosey used to bring the students out to see the plays in that time, in the Abbey and places.
I did indeed, and it was one of the things that, it was great fun. Sometimes you had to do an awful lot of persuading because, you know, the theatre wasn't an immediate experience for the kids like cinema. But I got them to go and see The Hostage in the Abbey by telling them it was set in a brothel, there were dirty songs in it, that they didn't have to come, really, if they felt they'd be offended. So we all packed into the bus and went in. They loved it, sang along with Don't Shove Your Granny Off the Bus and so on. But at the interval, six of the lads that I would have preferred to keep in sight disappeared and reappeared about 5 minutes later in the foyer of the Abbey with six bags of chips. And I think that may have created a first for the Abbey Theatre. And they quite ate their way without any bother to the interval and went in and watched. But two of the lads went back a fortnight later to see the same production, Brendan Behan's The Hostage. But there was one sport which I think most people would have said might have been perhaps the most exotic attempt to introduce something new into the lives of students here. Carmen Schmidt, who's here tonight, a long-serving and wonderful teacher, thought that it would be a great idea to take some of the kids on Wednesday afternoon across to the artificial ski slope in Kiltearnin.
Right, so
and
skiing team.
There was a minibus, and every Wednesday before the half-day, Mr. Carroll, headmaster, would come along and make announcements for the day, activities for the afternoon, soccer, swimming, whatever, camogie. But on this particular February morning or afternoon, just before we broke, he said, and there's a particular announcement here for the attention of Miss Schmidt's skiing class. Due to snow on the slope, there'll be no skiing.
It could only happen in Ireland.
but it was a case, though, that no experience should be outside the realm or the ken of the students. And if that meant recreating the Sound of Music up in the Cooley Peninsula on a freezing weekend, so be it. It kept some of us now ageing teachers perhaps a little bit fitter than we might have been.
But Anton, drama was part of the curriculum here as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, drama was part of the curriculum, and we actually won the Dublin Shakespeare Festival Award 1 year, where Enda mentioned it there earlier. Roddy and Paul, I think, collaborated on a rewrite of King Lear. And the adjudicator at the final thing before, he literally actually fell off a seat and rolled around the floor in laughter. But there was a lot of involvement, obviously. Paul was just an absolutely fantastic talent to have here.
This is Paul Mercier, of course.
Paul Mercier, yeah. Like, apart from the sort of in-house compositions and so forth, like, there were other plays, like Willie Russell's plays and so forth, like Our Day Out, which involved actually our students with professional actors. It was absolutely a marvellous production. And, you know, a lot of it was so, the sets and so forth were so imaginative. They were really of a professional standard, you know. So there was fantastic talent, and the enthusiasm among the students was brilliant. Like, the enthusiasm which they just threw themselves into this was quite amazing.
Roddy, what did you do with King Lear? Did you hammer an awful job?
He was a blacksmith.
No,
I remember he ran a pest extermination empire.
Yeah. But the only basic rule was that everything we did Shakespeare twice or three times, and we did Wuthering Heights and Animal Farm, and they were always located in Kilbarrick.
Yeah.
So these big Shakespearean moments were in Kilbarrick, outside the school there, you know. I just remember we had, you know, when King Lear starts blow, wind, blow and crack your cheeks, we had angels who started a hairdryer, and they had a watering can, and we took a literal interpretation of the thing, you know.
Was it Lee Roddy who had the flippers?
That's right, yeah. They have flippers and goggles and, you know.
So we Lear. Just...
Yeah, blow and crack your cheeks, you know. And it was as he went, it all made a kind of a sense at the time. But it was wonderful, you know. In retrospect, but even at the time, it was absolutely wonderful. And it was just seeing the talent as well, you know.
I've got Jason Morden down here as well. He's another writer who was going to this school. Did they inspire you, people like Roddy and Paul, or Shakespeare's, like, or did you come across them?
I think I had perhaps
pretensions before I got here, so I am. so perhaps I wasn't inspired, and I was sharper than a serpent's tooth. If we're going to continue the Lear thing, but it was encouraging to see that people who you knew and you saw on a daily basis were achieving some success,
and that Shakespeare wasn't completely alien to you. Well, Shakespeare was integral to the life in Kilbarrick. Shakespeare said his plays in Kilbarrick. Was that not interesting?
I don't remember these things that these people are talking about. I may have been gone by then. So I don't remember plays being produced here or anything like that. So.
I don't remember much over the past 20 years myself, in fairness. But there you go. But the quick question I suppose we've got to ask now is, this has been here since 1974, it's inspired writers, it's brought a new ethos into education, has sprint teams, it has winners of Shakespeare Awards, it has great footballers, and now you're closing. Why?
Well, the bottom line really is that there are far too many schools in the area. That is, in terms of a sort of distant analysis. If you looked at it from a distance, you'd say, look, at North East Dublin has 14 second-level schools. They have room for 9,000 students, but there are only 6,000 students in the area. So, therefore, there is an oversupply of schools. So, we've got to...
You've got to lose 3,000 places.
Yeah, we've got
to... So, the worst school in the area is Greendale. Get rid of it.
Right. We would have been very happy to accept that, Porrick, if there had been some sort of criteria set and said, look, we are going to set a set of criteria, and any school that doesn't measure up is going to be culled. That would be fine. But that didn't happen. There was no consultation whatsoever. We were presented with a sort of so-called rationale which said, look, the building will need refurbishment, and the refurbishment would cost a lot of money. So really, we shouldn't spend this kind of money when we have places that don't need refurbishment, so therefore we will close it. So they completely ignore the fact that we had, say, 1,000 adult education students, that we had initiatives which were not to be found in the other schools in the area, such as integration, all the so-called government priorities like breaking the cycle of disadvantage. We participated very enthusiastically in all of those. And... a lot of the teaching methodologies and so forth, employed in the school were quite innovative. And as other people have said earlier, the relationship between teachers and students was quite different and arguably unique. You know, there was, the whole thing was characterised by friendliness.
But why could that happen? Is it because you have 4.5 acres of prime land next to a dart site looking out in the sea and you're worth a lot of cash? Is that what's happening here? Is this cash calling the shots here again?
In a word, probably yes.
Roddy, this is sad, the whole heart being thrown out of a community, the school gone.
Well, it is a community school and it was very much part of the community, so I think the message is an insulting one, They're closing down the school. Ask any barrister in the country, where they went to school. It's probably one of 5 or 6 schools they went to, Ask somebody who went to Greendale next year, where did you go to school? I go to a school that no longer exists. And I think it's an insult to the place. It's an insult to the people who went there. It's an insult to the teachers who taught here. We were here right through the 80s and the 90s. We empowered people. We did have one of the reasons why I loved the job, because I felt that it did serve a very strong purpose. And it just seems to me, it's not old time's sake that makes me angry, because I don't think the place should stay open just because I was here for a while. But it's just that sense that it was a community school and is a community school.
Sophie, you said the school is closing down?
Yes, very. I've taught many places and at every level since then, but I have never, since I left here, I've never encountered students with quite that spirit and with quite that willingness to see all the possibilities of education. And I think it is a great shame. I think we had a terrific opportunity. I think we made the best of the opportunity, and I think it is a crying shame that it should be closed.
Can you do anything about it, Anton?
Oh no, it's a fait accompli. The community are very hurt, very disappointed, and many of them would still sort of rail against the whole idea of closure, but you don't want to be a King Canute. There is no point. The tide is coming in and we're going to have to retreat and we'll be out of here. We'll be off the shore by June 23rd about. So we have no idea what's going to happen to
anybody. What's going to happen to the treasure the school has created? The archives, the tapes of the shows, the records, the relay team, the whole body of beauty the school has created. What's going to happen to that?
We don't know. There are absolutely no provisions agreed or even proposed at this stage to deal with archival material, to deal with, say, even the decommissioning of labs, to deal with the decommissioning of computers. There is nothing agreed about the termination of the employment of the people who work here. Absolutely nothing agreed. It's all up in the air, and I think I would have to go a lot of the way with what Roddy says. It is probably something that would not happen in a more middle-class area. I think the area has been treated abominably.
Brian Mullins just joined us all the way from wherever you came from, sir. Donegal used to be in. Are you sad the school is closing?
I suppose I am, yeah. I'm sad for the students that are here and the people, the teachers that are still here and the staff members. It is the end of a huge entity that made a huge contribution to the area.
And what was it like when you were here? Was it great fun?
It was a lot of fun, yeah.
Were the footballers any good?
A lot of fun. Very good footballers, excellent. They were from all over the country, from parts of Donegal and Hoth and Kilbarrick and Sutton and Foxfield and Briarfield and everywhere. So it was multicultural and multi-county and everything like that. But they competed well.
By the way, on that one, Park, we had a teachers' team, and we used to go on tour down the country to bait the larder to fill us up in County Meath and places like that. You know, we had a formidable.
Well, we had Brian Mullins, you could do a fair bait.
Yeah, yeah.
I was only the boy.
He was under the generalship of his midfield partner.
Very good. It's been a great pleasure to be here. On this sad occasion, it's very sad, this is my first time to be in Green Dinn, and I probably won't be here next year, it'll be bulldozed. Thank you very much, Roddy Doyle, Anton Carroll, Sophia Hillen, Enda Welch, Stephen Mooney, Paul Mercer, Jason Mordant, Brian Mullins, and Seamus Sosie, Goramila Mahagilug. Paul Mercer came in the door, just got to say hello to you. He just came in the door. Paul, just two words, what I have you. Cén mina fáilte.
Go raibh mina maith.
Are you very sad the school is closing?
I am. I'm sad. I was angry earlier, but I'm sadder now. Yeah. I think it's... And I have to say, I haven't felt as nervous. The last time I felt this nervous was the day I started here. That's all I'll say. It's quite extraordinary. But I'm sorry I'm late. But sure, they've said it all anyway.
Good man, Paul. And they said a lot about you and the influence and the help you gave them all. Thank you very much, Paul Mercer. Thanks to everybody from Greendale Community School for contributing to tonight's programme. School Principal Anton and everybody here, past and present, thank you very much for being here. I hope you enjoyed this week's edition of the 11th Hour podcast. The 11th Hour is live on RTÉ Radio 1, Mondays to Fridays at 11 p.m. From me, Páraic Branagh, and the rest of the team in the 11th Hour, Slán.